I think to enable us to give full time to our speakers and give you an opportunity to ask questions as well, we'd like to commence right away. I'm sure that all of you realize that the question of the authenticity of, the validity of during particular periods, and the current status of the Adam-God theory are still current problems with us. We need only to be reminded of the recent talk by Elder Bruce McConkie entitled Seven Deadly Heresies to know that in the mind of at least one person the Adam-God idea is one that to believe in now puts one in the category of an apostate, and yet we're dealt with the dilemma of the fact that there seems to be some evidence that it was believed in strongly by many leaders early. Perhaps I'm scooping or unduly prefacing some of the comments of the author, but it still is a relevant topic for discussion, and we're very happy to have Cully Christensen with us this afternoon to discuss the Adam-God doctrine reappraised as an evolutionary step in the development of the Mormon doctrine of deity. Brother Christensen will be responded to by Steve Christensen. I don't think there's a relationship, is there? Steve is a local businessman here in Salt Lake. This perhaps covers up the fact that he is one of our great Mormon scholars, students, researchers, collector of old Mormon books, involved on a church level in making decisions about doctrinal development, very astute and adept at being able to comment on this paper. So first, the C. Christensen, followed by S. Christensen.
Thank you. I might say parenthetically that this paper was rather skillfully placed behind the paper that preceded in this room, having concluded that there's no real standard for right and wrong. So from that, I think we can take some comfort. Of all Latter-day Saint teachings, few, if any, have proved more inscrutable and heterodoxical than the pre-1900 teachings relating to the divinity of Adam. On the one hand, these teachings were extolled as one of the most glorious revealments in the economy of heaven, while on the other hand, they have been decried as false doctrine. Such a contradiction within the Mormon two-celled matrix of right and wrong presents a doctrinal quagmire, the resolution of which lies not only in understanding the doctrine itself, but in comprehending its historical setting and doctrinal development as well. This paper concerns itself with the historical development of the Mormon doctrine of deity, hoping to stimulate further research in an effort to resolve the quagmire while at the same time avoiding the emotionality of the right-wrong matrix. Most members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are surprised to discover differences between the restored church and current Latter-day teachings. Change, however, is the central theme of Joseph Smith's theology. And in this regard, no one has so literally interpreted as did Joseph Smith and applied with such practicality the Savior's admonition that we become perfect as our Father in heaven. The attainment of this objective can only be achieved through change. Joseph's teachings, since termed eternal progression, stress an evolutionary change in one's thoughts, knowledge, and being as one progresses to actually become a ruling deity. Accordingly, after 150 years of progression, one would expect modern-day Mormonism to reflect more refined and advanced doctrinal precepts over its infant state. By this same logic, one would expect the doctrinal concepts of the 1830 church to be more fundamental and suited to the understanding of a generation who considered God to be an ethereal composite of good, power, and knowledge, who considered God to be a non-entity embodying a holy trinity, and who considered Adam to be the man of sin personally responsible for the decadent nature of mankind. That the church as a body was expected to grow by precept is reflected in the Doctrine and Covenants, where the elders of the church were told, "Behold, ye are little children, ye cannot bear all things now, ye must grow in grace and in the knowledge of truth." With this background, one should not be surprised to find a dearth of information relating to Joseph Smith's first vision during the formative years of the Church. Yet Joseph's vision is the very basis whereby contemporary Latter-day Saints understand the pluralistic and anthropomorphic nature of the Godhead. Furthermore, history bears out that Joseph's first vision had little, if any, theologic impact on the Church's concept of God prior to 1842. And since the complete account of the first vision was largely written in 1839 and published for general dissemination in 1842, it is difficult to determine exactly what the pre-1840 Godhead doctrine was in the Church. If one, however, consults the Theology on the Doctrine of the Church of the Latter-day Saints, better known as the Lectures on Faith, one may, and I stress may, conclude that the saints were to believe that the Savior had a body in contrast to the Father, who is described as a personage of spirit. This fifth lecture states, "There are two personages who constitute the great, matchless, governing, and supreme power over all things, by whom all things were made and created. They are the Father and the Son. The Father being a personage of spirit, glory and power possessing all perfection and fullness, and the Son, who was in the bosom of the Father, a personage of tabernacle." It continues, "How many personages are there in the Godhead? Two, the Father and the Son. What is the Father? He is a personage of glory and power. And what is the Son? First, he is a personage of tabernacle." Why, we might ask, with these teachings, were the saints allowed to labor with incomplete concepts? What reason could Joseph have had to withhold his encounter from God, to withhold his encounter with God from the Church, which would have contributed to their understanding of deity? BYU history professor James B. Allen suggests the following explanation. A possible explanation for the fact that the story of the first vision was not generally known in the 1830s is sometimes seen in Joseph's conviction that experiences such as these should be kept from the general public because of their extremely sacred nature. It represented one of his most profound spiritual experiences, and he could well have decided to circulate it only privately until he could feel certain that in relating it, it would not receive again the general ridicule of friends. Since Joseph's experience lost none of its sacredness, his decision to make it known to the saints must have awaited them the development of a foundation upon which the saints, that is his friends, could accept it without ridicule. It is well known that the first vision account was not originally used to determine, or to demonstrate rather, the pluralistic and anthropomorphic nature of the Godhead, yet the account does embody these concepts, which, had they been revealed on unprepared minds, might well have proved too great a contradiction to have been accepted and may have been met with ridicule, as suggested by Dr. Allen. Thus, the first vision account, although possibly not a direct endowment or expansion on the Godhead doctrine, does barometer a change within the general membership toward receptivity to a more developed Godhead theology, preparing the saints, as it were, in the lesser to receive the greater. It is also worthy of note that the 1842 account of the first vision does not specifically identify God the Father as a tabernacle being, but rather ascribes to him these properties. Hence, by accepting the first vision account, the saints also accepted the inferred concept that God the Father possessed attributes common to tabernacle beings. In this way, the saints were prepared to receive the pronouncement that followed a year later at Ramus. Said Joseph, "The Father has a body of flesh and bones, as tangible as man, the Son also. But the Holy Ghost has not a body of flesh and bones, but is a personage of spirit. Were it not so, the Holy Ghost could not dwell in us." This speech that took place in 1843, according to T. Edgar Lyon, marked a theological landmark in the development of the Mormon Godhead doctrine. Yet, this was not Joseph's boldest step in declaring or advancing the Godhead doctrine. This step he took in 1844 when, in the King Follett Discourse, Joseph revealed concepts for the first time publicly relating to man's eternal progression. In Joseph's own words, he said, "God himself was once as we are now, and is an exalted man. He was once a man like us. Yea, God himself, the Father of us all, dwelt on an earth the same as Jesus Christ did. You have got to learn how to become gods yourselves, the same as all gods have done before you." Here Joseph for the first time publicly declared that the Father and the Son are not only separate beings of tabernacle, but are two of many gods. More shocking than this was the concept that God had once been a man such as you and I. With this disclosure, the doctrine of eternal progression would appear to be fully developed. Yet, these concepts formed only the rudiments from which the temple ceremony developed. Within this ceremony, the inductee acquires a more expanded concept of God, as he portrays the process through which he must pass to become God. From such, each member was to obtain a fuller, more tangible vision of God. The temple ceremony, however, by no means represented a final consummation of the Godhead doctrine, for Joseph taught a yet more developed theology to an elite inner circle of trusted friends. Benjamin F. Johnson spoke of this inner society when he related a meeting of a council or select circle of the prophet's most trusted friends, of which, in his own words, not all constituted church authorities were members. It was as a member of this circle that Brigham Young and others learned the Adam God doctrine. Following Joseph's death and the saints' retreat to the isolation of the Rocky Mountains, Brigham apparently felt it time to give the saints yet another endowment of knowledge concerning the nature of God. At the 1852 priesthood conference in April, Brigham revealed that God the Father not only had a body, that he is not only one of many gods, that he was not only once a man like us, but is in fact Father Adam. In his controversial discourse recorded in the Journal of Discourses, Volume 1, pages 51 and 52, he said the following: "When our Father Adam came into the Garden of Eden, he came into it with a celestial body, and brought Eve, one of his wives, with him. He is our Father and our God, and the only God with whom we have to do. Jesus, our elder brother, was begotten in the flesh by the same character that was in the Garden of Eden, and who is our Father in heaven." Although apologists have claimed that this sermon has been misrecorded or misunderstood, the specificity of subsequent statements by Brigham Young leaves no room for doubt that he indeed considered Adam to be not only the procreative father of our spirits, but the physical progenitor of the Savior as well. In a subsequent sermon delivered in St. George, in the St. George Temple in 1877, he said, "Adam had begotten all the spirits that were to come to this earth, and Eve, our common mother, who is the mother of all living, bore these spirits in the celestial world. Father Adam's only begotten in the spirit world, who according to the flesh is the only begotten as it is written." History further bears out that Brigham repeatedly taught this doctrine throughout his 33-year tenure as president of the church, and that the Adam God doctrine was infused throughout every avenue of doctrinal input. At this point, one would naturally inquire after the origin of Brigham's teachings. Certainly, one would expect confirmation of the doctrine to come by way of revelation. However, the origin of the doctrine Brigham clearly ascribed to Joseph Smith. This he declared to Orson Pratt in an 1860 meeting of the Quorum of the Twelve, which had assembled to deliberate Orson's false teachings. The following dialogue took place as Orson accuses Brigham of teaching the Adam God doctrine contrary to Joseph's revelations. Orson Pratt: "I would like to enumerate items. Firstly, preached and published that Adam is the father of our spirit and the father of our bodies. When I read the revelations given to Joseph, I read directly the opposite." Brigham Young: "It was Joseph's doctrine that Adam was God. God comes to the earth and eats and partakes of the fruit. Joseph could not reveal what was revealed to him, or if people had it revealed, it was not told." Further evidence that Joseph introduced this doctrine is the personal testimony of many of his most trusted associates and plural wives. John Taylor, for example, is quoted as saying that he heard Joseph say that Adam is the father of our bodies. Who is to say that he is not the father of our spirits? Although this mild Adam God assertion forces a conclusion by the hearer, it does document Joseph as having postulated Adam God concepts. Anti-Mormon writers agree that Joseph did more than just entertain these ideas, for the Nauvoo Expositor in its second resolution attributed such false and damnable doctrines directly to Joseph. It states, "We have for many years borne with the individual follies of Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith, and inasmuch as they have introduced false and damnable doctrines into the church, such as the plurality of gods above the God of this universe, and his liability to fall with all of his creations." A God's liability to fall with all of his creations is the same doctrine taught by Brigham Young in describing Adam as the creator and father of our spirit, who fell to this world from a glorified, resurrected state. Like the expositor, the Warsaw Message documents Adam Gott's concepts as being contemporary with Joseph Smith. In a poetic expose of Mormon doctrine, it describes deities as taking wives to worlds which they had created. The fifth verse of this poem states, "A tenfold glory, that's the prize, without it you're undone, but with it you will shine as bright as the shining sun. There you may reign like mighty gods, creating worlds so fair, at least a world for every wife that you take with you there." It was perhaps to avoid just such remonstrative backlash that Joseph kept this doctrine within the cloistered domain. On the same note, one wonders why Brigham in 1852 unveiled the doctrine with such explicitness that even those who did not have ears to hear heard. Surely he knew. He knew the doctrine would become a point of ridicule. Indeed, his Adam God teachings have not only heightened persecutory sentiments, but have become a source of internal division. Such division evidences the fact that Brigham's teachings were not universally accepted within the church. This lack of acceptance is reflected in many of his subsequent remarks. Characteristic is the following. "Some years ago, I advanced the doctrine with regard to Adam being the Father and God. This will be a curse to many of the elders of Israel because of their folly with regard to it. Yet they grovel in darkness and will. It is one of the most glorious revealments in the economy of heaven, yet the world holds it in derision. Had I revealed the doctrine of baptism for the dead instead of Joseph Smith, there are those around me who would have ridiculed the idea until doomsday. But," says he, "they are ignorant and stupid, like the dumbass." Such lack of acceptance may have been due to a lack of understanding, for the Deseret News in 1860 reported that the high priest and the Malad ward were contending one with another concerning some points of doctrine which they did not understand. That point of dispute being, was Adam our God? Furthermore, the Adam God doctrine has become a point of contention for every anti-Mormon writer to the present day. It has been used as a tool to rend the church from without and divide it from within. This may be the precise reason why we read nothing about the Adam God doctrine or teachings under the presidency of John Taylor. It must be remembered that during his presidency, the church is being sorely tried and persecuted on other fundamental issues. Plural marriage was the overriding preoccupation of the day. Promulgation of other divisionary doctrines can only be seen as being counterproductive to the church as a body. But with the plural marriage issue settled in 1890, anti-Mormon factions again began to focus on the anti-Christian doctrines of Mormonism. Of these, the Adam God doctrine seemed most obtrusive. To the Christian world, it is not only anti-Christian, but represents the heathenistic doctrine of ancestor worship. In some quarters, the Adam God doctrine became an effective tool in thwarting LDS missionary activity. Such is the case in point in the California mission under then-President Ephraim H. Nye in 1897. According to historical events, things were progressing well in the California mission until October 30, 1897, when the following article occurred in the Fresno Morning Republican, which announces the proselyting intentions of two Mormon missionaries. Elders George A. Poulter and Howard Bushnell are described here as being plausible, well-appearing, and neatly dressed. This article further goes on to describe their intentions of making house-to-house visitations. Tracts are left with everyone who will accept them, and in this manner, a systematic canvas of the town is being made for converts. A local reverend, C.A. Munn, apparently was incensed over this positive exposure given the missionaries, and he responded 11 days later by initiating his own anti-Mormon crusade in the local newspaper. His November 10 article contains the following relative to Adam God. Brigham Young, in a sermon in the Tabernacle in Salt Lake City on April 19, 1852, said, "When our father Adam came into the Garden of Eden, he came into it with a celestial body and brought Eve, one of his wives, with him. He helped to make and organize this world. He is Michael, the archangel of the Ancient of Days, and about whom holy men have written and spoken. He is our Father and our God, and the only God with whom we have to do. Of his Son Jesus Christ," Brigham said, "I tell you that God was the Father of Jesus Christ, just as I am the Father of my Son." Reverend Munn followed this initial tack with three more abusive articles printed 2 days later in the Fresno Morning Republican and the Fresno Weekly Republican. One of these articles describes the missionaries as emissaries of evil, and again holds the Adam God doctrine up to ridicule. The local elders responded on November 16 with a capable article in defense of their position, Their article, however, is mostly concerned with the demonstration of an anthropomorphic God and says nothing about the Adam-God issues raised by Munn. The Reverend Munn, however, was quick to follow up with another article printed November 19th against the Church and Mormon doctrines. To counter the venomous campaign of Reverend Munn, then-Mission President Ephraim Nye responded on December 1 in the Fresno Morning Republican with an article in defense of Mormon doctrines. This same article was published on December 3rd in the Fresno Weekly Republican. In this article, President Nye frankly denies the Adam-God doctrine as taught by Brigham Young and claimed that the Reverend rather misquoted Brigham by taking his discourse out of context. His article reads, Heman, that is, then quotes the world-renowned leader Brigham Young as saying that Adam is our father and our God and the only God with whom we have to do. Why does he not present the whole sermon? Simply because if he did, he would have no case. Now let us examine it in light of reason. Adam is one of the sons of God, and he is a brother of Jesus Christ and will be a God. He is not the God to whom we pray, nor does Brigham undertake to convey such an idea. We worship the God who placed Adam in the Garden of Eden. Reverend Munn, however, was not intimidated by Nye's boldness, and he responded by simply calling President Nye a liar. More politically, however, he said, notwithstanding President Nye to the contrary, the Mormon Church does teach that Adam is God, the supreme God, the creator of the world, our God and the only God with whom we have to do, and that Jesus is the Son by natural generation. The Mormon Church is polytheistic, and it teaches a plurality of gods that these may become gods, having been men. Munn's campaign was of sufficient impact to cause President Nye to write and obtain counsel from the First Presidency concerning his article and his treatment. Nye's letter and article to the Fresno newspaper were read at a meeting in the temple on December 16, 1897. Present at that meeting were the First Presidency, with President Wilford Woodruff presiding and the Quorum of the Twelve. Nye's letter to Apostle Richards reads, Dear Brother, I herewith send you a clipping from the Fresno Republican published in the Fresno County, California, when our elders, Poulter and Bushnell, went there about the 15th of October or a little later. The reporter of the Fresno Republican met them and gave them a good write-up. This brought forth a letter from the Reverend C. A. Munn of Fresno. In his attack, he has brought up the old story, so often flung in our faces, especially by the Josephites throughout the state, and now commonly referred to as the Adam-God story. And the opportunity seemed so good to me that I could not resist the temptation to answer him and all the Josephites on that question. I studied the matter clearly and very carefully, and I felt that I was right, so I forged ahead. Will you kindly look over the piece, and if I am not correct, please point out to me the errors, as this is a matter we have got to meet continually. It is the stronghold of the Josephites, and one they never fail to use on us. And our elders are all lame on that point and are afraid to answer upon it. They therefore sidetrack it in the most convenient way, and in each case the result is that the elders of the reorganized say, you are afraid to meet it. And in fact, as a rule, our young elders and all that we have out here are unable to meet the question and have to dodge it the best way they can. The story referred to is a quotation from one of President Young's sermons, wherein he says that Adam is our father, the only God with which we have to do. One would certainly expect the foregoing to stimulate discussion among the brethren that day. The private journals of those present would seem to corroborate this conclusion. The diary of John Henry Smith documents the meeting and those in attendance, but says nothing about a discussion of Adam God. Wilford Woodruff's journal states that a letter from N was read. The Brigham Young Jr. journal sheds more light on the discussion. He writes, meeting at 11 a.m. in the temple, Adam is our father and God. No use to discuss it with the Josephites or anyone else. From this, it would appear that the Adam God was discussed and that the consensus of the brethren, according to Brigham Young Jr., that is, was that Adam is indeed our father, but that it was best to avoid bringing up the issue. Apostle Franklin D. Richards' diary carries a more complete account of the discussion. The completeness of his account is owing to the fact that Apostle Richards brought the matter before the brethren in behalf of President Nye. His journal entry for December 16, 1897, in part reads, Letter and article by E. H. Nye was read and highly approved, but no action as to the dealing with Adam our father and God subject. It becomes apparent that President Nye's treatment of Adam God was of some concern. However, no action was taken, which probably means that no corrections were made. On December 17th, Apostle Richards drafted a letter to President Nye conveying the counsel of the brethren in this matter. The letter was mailed on December 18th. His journal continues, December, Saturday 18, 1897, sent President E.H. Nye a letter of a decision of council about approving his article to the Fresno Republican and copy of President Young's remarks about Adam, our father, as contained in Volume 1 of the Journal of Discourses. A copy of the letter containing the decision of the presidency in the 12 can be found in the letter book of the Richards Family Collection. The contents of this letter are understandably concerned with the Adam Dodds treatment. Here it is referred to as a point of more advanced doctrine, too precious a pearl to be cast before swine. President Nye was further counseled to rescue the Adam God pearl the best he could by any means as the Spirit may suggest. The letter reads as follows. On receipt of your letter of the 4th, I conferred with President Joseph F. Smith, and we concluded to present the matter to the Council of the First Presidency and the 12 Apostles. Both your letters to me and the article to the Fresno Republican were read. Each of the presidents and several of the apostles expressed themselves well pleased with your article, that it evidenced skill and valor for truth, and they did not see how it could be much improved. The council did not deem it wise to lay out any line of procedure with which to deal with the subject, but felt that it is best to avoid bringing it up, and to do the best we can as the Spirit may suggest when it is thrust upon us. Your having got so many of the Josephites was received with marks of particular pleasure. This, like many other points of more advanced doctrine, is too precious a pearl to be cast before swine. But when the swine get hold of them, let us rescue them by the help of the Spirit as best we can, thinking it may be convenient for you to have President Young's sayings on that subject and enclose a copy from his sermon in the first volume of the Journal of Discourses. That this letter is dealing exclusively with Adam God is obvious in the last paragraph, wherein he refers to Brigham's Adam God's sermon in Volume 1 of the Journal of Discourses. This letter reflects an official endorsement which, in effect, sanctions the public denial of a doctrine which is believed to be true. It documents the 1897 First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve as considering the Adam God doctrine too precious a pearl to be trampled underfoot. As the decision of the council represents the collective decision of the individual members, this letter suggests more than implicit endorsement of the Adam God doctrine by the individual members, the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve. Whether all members gave equal endorsement cannot from the letter be determined. Certain it is, however, that no decision of the council would be given contrary to the personal approval of the presiding officer, which in this case was Wilford Woodruff. This letter reveals a formal, although covert, church policy of suppressing an explosive doctrinal issue from those who would exploit the same. In the words of Apostle Richards, the Adam God doctrine is a point of more advanced doctrine, too precious a pearl to be cast before swine. This policy can only be seen as an attempt to retrieve pearls which have been trodden underfoot. Within the scope of this paper, we have seen the Adam God doctrine evolve as a progressive concept in the Latter-day Saint doctrine of deity. Its introduction by Joseph Smith was traced to fruition publicly under Brigham Young, and then to public withdrawal under Wilford Woodruff. We have documented the public withdrawal of this doctrine not because of its untruth, but because it is too far advanced to precept for general or public consumption. This policy appears to have been promoted by division from within and derision from without. The objective of this policy can only be interpreted as a measure to preserve unity and promote expansion.
I think Alan gives me a little too much credit once he passed my introduction as anything more than a businessman. It might interest you to know that sometimes I consider myself lucky if I am at least a businessman, having never formally graduated from college. I do collect rare books, but don't consider myself any type of an authority, and today I feel somewhat like a young Daniel cast before a den of scholarly lions, so you'll forgive me if I appear partially nervous. In order to be precise and avoid misunderstanding, I've chosen to read major portions of my paper today. It is with great care that I wish to respond to Cully's paper and the issue of reappraising the Adam God doctrine. My concern is twofold. First, it is difficult to reappraise the I Am God doctrine when its first appraisals are mostly insufficient, outdated, or possibly too biased. Aside from Rodney Turner's popular 1953 master's thesis, there exists, in my opinion, no other major objective scholarly study on the I Am God issue within Mormonism. My second concern, and one quite personally important to myself, is that this issue has become increasingly sensitive within the walls of Orthodox Mormonism. Therefore, rather than debate the theological veracity of the theory, allow me to concentrate on the historical implications of the paper. For the benefit of those present to whom this idea might seem a new concept, let me offer a simple statement, not to detract from Cully's paper, but just so that we might all be thinking the same. The I Am God theory or belief is that God, the Father of Jesus Christ and the Father of our spirits, is none other than Adam, who lived in the Garden of Eden. There is more to the theory, however, neither time nor purpose will permit a full discussion of its appendages. Before I respond directly to this paper, let me make a general observation on the subject. Historically, my way of counting it, there have been five approaches to the I Am God issue. First, to avoid the issue altogether. Second, to claim that statements interpreted by some as supportive of the I Am God belief have actually been misunderstood, misquoted, and/or recorded incorrectly. Third, another explanation is to state that Brigham Young might have suggested the doctrines in the 50s or 60s, however, later in his life discarded the idea. Fourth, there is the idea that the evidence can be explained by means of a dual Adam theory. This utilizes the word Adam as a title, which, depending on the statement, could refer to either God the Father or his son Adam. Depending upon the version which one hears, God the Father, acting as an Adam, or first man, comes down to the earth with celestial wife who gives birth to a son whom they call Adam. His son Adam becomes the first mortal man upon the earth after the fall. The fifth and last approach is to state that there have been leaders within the church, preeminently Brigham Young, who believed in the so-called Adam God theory. For those whose approach falls within this last category, some believe the idea to be true, others consider it false, irregardless of who taught it, and many do not state an opinion at all. After this introduction, let me now continue into the body of the paper. Let's begin on some common ground and see where Cully and I agree, and then delve into some issues where I think questions ought to be answered in regards to his paper. First, did Brigham Young teach and therefore believe the I Am God concept? Cully's paper gives us a documentary yes. With this, I would agree. Let me share my consensus in the well-formed and oft-quoted words of Professor Rodney Turner. Referring to Brigham Young in his master's thesis, he states, "A careful, detached study of his available statements, as found in the official publications of the Church, will admit of no other conclusion than that the identification of Adam with God the Father by President Brigham Young is an irrefutable fact. While there are a great many of his expressions which may appear to contradict this, they fail to reveal his views on this particular subject with the clarity, objectivity, an absence of equivocation which would permit them equal weight with his other pronouncements. At best, it may be said that they becloud his more direct statements, but in all honesty, it must be admitted that they fail to actually deny them." End of quote. A second question. Did Cully's paper establish the I Am God concept as an evolutionary step in the development of a Mormon doctrine of deity? Though it is an interesting paper, I believe that it falls short of its title. The major problem is its lack of establishing a central theme. There are too many ideas woven too loosely together. How can the I Am God concept be considered as an evolutionary step when it would appear to be in total opposition to the current belief that Adam is not God the Father, but rather his son? To evolve, to me, seems to imply a gradual development to something higher, yet still similar. Those who believe in the I Am God theory see it as an alternative idea and not as a logical step towards Mormonism's current doctrine on deity. It was not the evolving, progressive step that has been suggested. but perhaps this is just a problem in semantics. Therefore, let me suggest a new theme for Tully's paper, that of an historical appraisal of the rise and fall of the atom-god theory. Let me turn my attention to six different areas of historical problems and questions which are raised by the paper with which I'd like to deal with. First, did early Mormonism believe God the Father to be an ethereal spirit God, as the paper suggests? This is a case where too much tread is taken on too little evidence. Many questions need to be answered before this assumption can be dealt with adequately. Questions such as, who authored the lectures on faith, or more important, how did those present react to this teaching? How was it interpreted? Did they write about it in their diaries? What was their belief in relation to the Godhead before accepting Mormonism? Did their terminology mean the same to them as it does to us today? On what other occasions might similar doctrine have been taught? Which I feel is a very crucial question. Can it be shown that this was a prevailing opinion among the saints of that day? Before an adequate answer or response can be given, I believe that more research is needed. A second concern, in speaking of the doctrine taught in the King Follett sermon, Cully states in his paper, here Joseph for the first time publicly declared that the Father and the Son are not only separate beings of tabernacle, but are two of many gods. Cully goes on to state, more shocking than this is the concept that God had once been a man such as you and I. With this disclosure, the doctrine of eternal progression would appear to be fully developed. Yet these concepts formed only the rudiments from which the temple ceremony developed. Within this ceremony, the inductee acquires a more expanded concept of God as he portrays the process through which he must pass to become a God. For such, each member was to obtain a fuller and more tangible vision of God. Thus ends quotation from his paper. Again, questions beg an answer. How do we know what the original endowment was like? Did the participants gain a more expanded concept of God himself, or was the endowment directed towards more personal progression and reflection? What were its teachings relative to God? Where is the documentation to support this broad assumption? The third point, and shortly after this statement I've quoted from the paper, he goes on to state, the temple ceremony by no means represents the final consummation of the Godhead doctrine. For Joseph taught yet a more developed theology to an elite inner circle of trusted friends. Benjamin F. Johnson spoke of this inner society when he related, and Cully quotes, meeting of a council or select circle of the prophet's most trusted friends, of which not all constituted church authorities were members. End of statement. A key phrase which Cully left out is the one in the same paragraph of Benjamin F. Johnson's remarks, which states that at times, referring to his council or inner circle of friends, it would exceed 50 in number. It is my opinion that with more research, it becomes obvious that the reference is in regards to the so-called Council of 50. In the words of Michael Quinn, the primary role of the Council of 50 was to symbolize the otherworldly world order that would be established during the millennial reign of Christ on earth. It is highly unlikely, in my opinion, that this group functioned as a theological study group of elitist friends. True it is that some members of this group also served as apostles and held membership in various prayer circles. These later groups would provide, to my way of thinking, more of a setting for theological discussion. A fourth point. After referring to this circle of elite inner friends, Cully states, it was as a member of this circle that Brigham and others learned the Adam-God doctrine. The question cries out, where is the documentation for this statement? A major question yet to be researched is, was Joseph Smith the source of the Adam-God doctrine? Thus far, all we have are a few second-hand references stating the case to be such. If Joseph Smith believed it, why didn't he introduce it publicly? Or where is it written in his private material that such was his belief, or such was the case? What about Orson Pratt, who told his fellow members of the Quorum of the Twelve that he never heard Joseph teach such doctrine? A fifth area of concern that I have with the paper and I hope to make this brief so that you might ask the questions that come to mind. Fifth, more attention needs to be paid to the efforts of Orson Pratt and possibly others who did not accept the theory. Was it ever preached to the church as an essential doctrine? Where belief was essential to one's salvation? Why was Orson Pratt allowed to remain as an apostle when his opposition to this theory was so bitter? It might be interesting to note that in the 1860 Quorum of the 12 Minutes referred to in the paper, that they dealt primarily with the argument, originally, of whether or not God progressed in knowledge, that the Adam-God conflict or belief of Brigham Young kind of comes in as a secondary issue as it related to the subject. Six, was the withdrawal of the Adam-God doctrine really both covert and official? Were all of the presiding authorities involved in the 1897 meetings in official agreement? Did they all believe the Adam-God doctrine? Or was the consensus one of withdrawing the doctrine without a debate as to its status as a plain and precious pearl that had been cast before swine? President Nye refuted the doctrine publicly, but did he believe it or disbelieve it in private? Was it thought of as a church doctrine or as an opinion belonging to Brigham Young? Finally, what influence did Brigham Young have upon the thinking of his close associates? How was the thinking of Brigham Young affected after his death when he was no longer there? Enough for the questions. Now let me mention a few bright sides to the paper and then conclude. Two very positive things that I feel. First of all, is a willingness to discuss the issue in such an open manner. Second, and most important, is the mention of two relatively new sources of information, the 1860 Quorum of the 12 Minutes and the material relating to the E.H. Nye experience in California. Now, in summary, there exists a great need for further research and evaluation on the issues which these documents raise. The day has passed when only fundamentalists concern themselves with this issue. Hardly an anti-Mormon book comes to press but what there is a section dealing with the Adam-God problem. Accurate answers are needed in this garden patch of controversy which has long gone unweeded. Although Cully's paper is possibly not the definitive answer to this issue, possibly it is a beginning. Thank you.
Yes, I'm going to give you a chance. We appreciate both the paper and the thorough response. I'm sure that there'll be a lot of questions, and I think Steve has already mentioned about 50 of them that he has, and I think it's fair to offer the original author an opportunity to respond. I would like to add a question that you may want to respond to. I guess I feel personally concerned about the idea of the Adam-God theory as an evolutionary step. Evolution implies that any particular link in a progressing chain is tied to the character of the link which preceded it and contributes to the nature of that which follows it. And I wonder if it is an evolutionary step, or rather, continuing the biological metaphor, a mutancy that was cast out by not being selected. If it is maintained as an evolutionary step, then the author maintains that, at least as far as we know through 1897, it was considered to be true but kept secret. Therefore, what is the status of it now? Is it still considered to be true and still kept secret? Or if not considered to be true, what is the theological basis upon which we reject it and now speak so vociferously against it? Is it a pearl of advanced doctrine, or what is the basis for its rejection? So that gives you plenty to go by on a response, I guess.
Okay, firstly, I'm glad Steve, after reading this, asked himself questions. That was exactly the purpose of the paper. Yes, indeed, there are a lot of loose ends here. What I have attempted to do, however, was divert from the hysteria which surrounds the Adam-God doctrine and like quasi-Mormon doctrinal issues, try to attempt it and reappraise it for its original worth, which necessitates shedding off and throwing off some of our biases. However, the very purpose of this paper I mentioned on the first page, which was to stimulate further research into this area to resolve a supposed quagmire or contradiction that exists within the Mormon right-wrong matrix. As to the evolutionary title, evolutionary does not necessarily imply spontaneity. It does not necessarily imply something that's organic that evolves through personal interactions. Evolution, I have supported the thesis here, I believe, of doctrinal introduction on a progressively higher level as the saints were able to accommodate and accept that truth which was revealed. In this sense, and this is the thesis of the paper as well, that we receive line upon line, and that the saints did not receive at their very initial endowment in 1830 the full concept of the Godhead doctrine. Just as there are further issues and further light knowledge for us yet to receive, so was there a time in church history when the saints did not have a fullness of the knowledge of God. We today do not have that either. Therefore, to reject one or another thesis in light of absence of knowledge would be folly. What I have proposed here, however, is that the saints, that the Lord did reveal in a sequential fashion, which is evolutionary, in an evolving progressive fashion, which I tied in the last page of my paper, which I'm sure Steve did read, that we have seen the Adam God doctrine evolve as a progressive concept. And it would seem to follow, at least in my mind, but my way of thinking, the evolutionary progression in which we saw the Adam God doctrine evolve throughout church history, God initially being a spirit, to having had a body, and then it was ultimately Father Adam. Yes, there are some questions with regard to that need to be answered, particularly within our own personal minds. Now, as to whether or not the temple ceremony is the place where we, I believe Steve attacked the point that the temple ceremony, where I propose that it is the place where we do obtain a fuller, more tangible vision of God. This is innate. I think it goes without saying. Heber H.C. Kimball, however, did say exactly that. And certainly he was in a position to know. Steve again wonders whether or not the Council of 50, yes, indeed, I recognize the point that Benjamin F. Johnson did have reference to the Council of 50. Does nothing to alter the point of my argument, however. It indeed was the Council of 50, but to suppose that this was not a theologic group, I think is absurd. Certainly there were a theologic group. They were involved in establishing and maintaining the kingdom of God, as Klaus Hansen brought out, and this indeed is a theological group as well. But whether or not Joseph Smith is the source, I think I've given adequate information that people need to research, and I think I've tried at least to give a stimulus for areas of research. I think we can look for further enlightenment on those things. Now, as to whether or not Orson Pratt is the question, why was Orson Pratt not appraised of the Adam God doctrine? Well, I just read, I'm sure Steve read it as well, the minutes of the 1860 meeting where Orson Pratt said he did not hear Joseph Smith preach it, but yet Brigham Young said he did hear Joseph preach it. The only conclusion there is that Orson Pratt was not part of this inner circle. It should be remembered that Orson Pratt did turn his heels on Joseph Smith not once, but twice, and did turn his heels not once, but many times on Brigham Young and the other brethren in terms of lending them his support. Where is it essential to salvation? Well, Brigham Young said it was in Volume 1 of Journal Discourses, for example, and many other places in addition. Okay, now, the question is, was it a covert? Steve questions whether or not it was a covert policy. Well, it didn't happen openly. To me, that's covert. I don't know what else to say about that. And it did occur at the highest levels within the church. So it has to reflect a covert policy. Was it a purposeful? I think this is what Steve was probably getting at. Was it a purposeful, planned, premeditated attempt? I don't know. I think personally they found themselves carrying out a policy simply out of necessity. And as to the further question of how it evolved, the fact that we do not have, we may not have reached the epitome of evolution stemming from the Adam God concept does not imply that it was not an evolutionary concept to that point. Objects throughout nature, life certainly can evolve to a point and then devolve. The thesis here is that it has been withdrawn because it was considered by the church authorities at the highest level too precious a pearl for public dissemination. And how does it fit into our theology today? I'm not going to make an attempt to answer that. Thank you.